Support for this podcast comes from Avangrid.
This is definitely a blue-collar community, and I'm kind of a blue-collar guy.
Rick Sealscott didn't see himself as a farmer, but wasn't about to sell his grandparents' Ohio farm. An Avangrid wind farm pays millions to the community and landowners like him each year.
Farming's up and down, but the wind turbines give us steady income. We're holding on to the farm, and we're making money. And I would absolutely do it again.
Discover where energy meets humanity at avangrid.com.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Trump's top deputies deliver a blunt message to the party faithful. The Republicans are winning the fight, and it is a fight. And with Moonlight nominated for 8 Academy Awards this weekend, a conversation with its director about making sense of the world you come from and what it means to leave it behind. It's Friday, February 24th.
All right. CPAC is known for having important moments. And I think it's safe to say by a full room that this is one of those moments.
On Thursday afternoon, inside a convention hall just outside of Washington, the two most powerful advisors to President Trump walked onto a stage and settled into a pair of chairs.
And I think the first thing that would be appropriate after 30 days of running a continual sprint is to thank these two guys for what they've been doing.
Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus. One embodies the right-wing populism that brought Trump to power. The other, the Republican establishment that Trump is now disrupting.
Let me ask each one of you, what's the biggest misconception about what's going on in the Donald Trump White House?
Well, in regard to us two, I think the biggest misconception is everything that you're reading.
Jonathan Martin has covered the inside story of both political parties for years. Hey there, Jonathan. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So a year ago, probably the least controversial thing that you could possibly say was that conservatism was divided, because it very clearly was. There were 16 people running against each other for the Republican nomination. It was incredibly divisive. And a year later, we are hearing a message on stage.
Donald Trump, President Trump, brought together the party and the conservative movement. And I've got to tell you, if the party and the conservative movement are together, similar to Steve and I, it can't be stopped.
That there is unity within this conservative world. And the message was that Donald Trump created that unity.
He was the one person that was able to bring this party and this movement together.
Is that true?
No.
Why not?
He's the president of the United States, so I think there has been a rallying effect to him among many in his party, but he does not have unity across the board. In fact, to an almost unheard-of degree, people in his own party criticize him openly in ways that you just don't see in American politics.
So I don't give a damn what the president of the United States wants to do or anybody else wants to do. We will not waterboard. We will not torture.
You know, the more well-known critics like John McCain, who is very blunt, but even with, people like Senator McConnell, who will just say directly, I wish the president would stop tweeting so much.
I've been pretty candid with him and with all of you that I'm not a great fan of daily tweets.
Those kinds of critiques delivered publicly typically don't happen within a party at this level of American politics. And on a policy level, Michael, there are still considerable divisions, trade, immigration, the role of America in the world, all those issues still divide the Republican Party.
On Thursday, Steve Bannon articulated a vision for what he said this president's vision of conservatism is.
You know, I've said that there's a new political order that's being formed out of this, and it's still being formed.
And why he believes it stitches together all the different elements of conservatism.
We have wide and sometimes divergent opinions, but I think the center core of what we believe, that we're a nation with an economy, not an economy just in some global marketplace with open borders, but we are a nation with a culture and a reason for being. And I think that's what unites us.
And his argument is that what does bring those things all together is nationalism.
Well, this is the great question, is that, you know, Steve Bannon believes that in Donald Trump, he has found a sort of vehicle for what he has long wanted to do in terms of policy in this country. And I guess the reason I'm skeptical is because I just don't think that Trump is as deeply invested in these issues as Steve Bannon is. And, you know, President Trump has proven time and time again that what he cares significantly about is the coverage and the perception of him. And the great unanswered question of this presidency, this young presidency, is when those two things come into conflict, Michael, this sort of nationalistic vision that Bannon has and President Trump's obsession with his own popularity, what side does he take? And I don't think we fully know the answer to that yet.
Is there a example of that tension?
I mean, I think the issue that comes to mind that I've been really struck by over the Sound of Silence is this question about what to do with the children of people who are in this country illegally. This is something that President Trump ran on. He said that, you know, they would deport these individuals. And here we are over a month in, and he has not decided yet. And when he's been asked this question, he clearly struggles because he knows that the stories about taking this kind of action would be, you know, let's say less than flattering.
The audience at CPAC certainly responded positively to this message.
We want you to have our back.
How can we argue with that one window into whether or not nationalism and the Trumpism of this moment is actually bringing together conservatives?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, look, I don't think there's any question that he is a powerful president, and he is nudging a lot of conservatives towards his and Steve Bannon's outlook. I don't question that at all. But you can just look at polling right now, and you see the Republican views on trade much more skeptical now than they used to be. You know, Republican views on Vladimir Putin much more favorable than they used to be. So you're absolutely right that he is nudging the party toward the sort of vision that he has, and I think presidents often do that. What is striking, though, is that there is still significant resistance among the elected officials in the party that is not dissipating.
Which raises the really interesting question of whether or not Donald Trump is actually drawing together the disparate elements of the right, but he just hasn't brought along their elected leaders.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I had a conversation right before the inauguration with a couple of smart conservatives about this, and they are sort of Trump friendly. And what they said is that they were worried that Trump was a step ahead of the elected officials and that Trump did not have an infrastructure, that he's so far ahead of where a lot of the sort of official wing of the party is, that there's no think tanks, there's no caucus on the hill,
there's no white papers and research reports.
And this is the concern, that while some of his voters like it, there's still deep reluctance among both the elected officials and some of the donors in the Republican Party for his views.
We're so conditioned to it. I'm personally so conditioned to hearing about why President Trump isn't going to win the election, why a controversy in the primary is going to take down President Trump. But it was when I went home and got out of this town, and I went back to Kenosha, and I talked to my neighbor, and I said, "Bob, what do you think?" And he goes, "Man, I really love that Trump." And I said, Sandy, what do you think?" She says, "We're for Trump." And it was, as you all lived through it too, because you all had different people you were for, and you kept running into people that you know, and what did they kept telling you? They kept telling you, "Trump, Trump, Trump." And so,
tomorrow, okay?
President Trump will speak at CPAC on Friday. We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by Amelia Perez, Zoe Saldana, Carla Sofia Gascon, and Selena Gomez, star in director Jacques Audiard's audacious, genre-defying movie, hailed as the year's best picture. An electrifying odyssey boasting tour de force performances, liberating song and dance, and bold visuals. The London Standard calls it a work of brilliance. Time hails it an exuberant ode to human possibility. and Vanity Fair raves, there is no other movie like Emilia Perez, a thrilling reminder of the limitless potential of this medium. On Netflix in the US, UK, and Canada.
This podcast is supported by ACLU. The ACLU knows exactly what threats a second Donald Trump term presents, and they are ready with a battle-tested playbook. The ACLU took legal action against the first Trump administration 434 times, and they will do it again to protect immigrants' rights, defend reproductive freedom, safeguard free speech, and fight for all of our fundamental civil rights. Join the ACLU today to help stop the Extreme Project 2025 agenda. Learn more at ACLU.org.
I use New York Times Cooking at least 3 to 4 times a week.
I love sheet pan bibimbap. It said 35 minutes. It was 35 minutes.
The cucumber salad with soy, ginger, and garlic. Oh my God, that is just to die for.
This turkey chili has over 17,000 five-star ratings. So easy, so delicious.
The instructions are so clear, so simple, and it just works.
Hey, it's Eric Kim from New York Times Cooking. Come cook with us. Go to nytcooking.com.
The resonance of the movie Moonlight, the source of its acclaim, is in the intensely personal depiction of a young boy sorting out who he is while growing up poor, black, and gay in the Liberty City neighborhood of Miami.
You ever see the way he walk?
You watch his damn mouth.
You gonna tell him why the other boys kick his ass all the time? Huh? You gonna tell him?
While it's a work of fiction, it's infused with the childhood memories of the man who made it, the director Barry Jenkins. He talked recently in Miami with my colleague Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's an investigative reporter who has herself been deeply informed in her writing by her past and where she's come from.
You, like me, grew up like at the height of the crack epidemic.
Exactly.
And also at the height of movie making on the crack epidemic, right? Mm-hmm, New Jack City, Menace to Society, Boys in the Hood, which were made right in the thick of all of this happening. And so when you look at them, it's clear, right? How do you think the distance that you had in making this movie about that period shaped how this movie is different from those movies?
It's funny. It wasn't until I was 23 or 24 that I realized I had a rough childhood, and air quotes, a rough childhood, because you just normalize everything, you know? Most of my memory is about the normalcy of it hitting. I mean, there were songs people would play. There was a song called Your Mama on Crack Rock. You remember that song?
Of course.
And I was like, back then, I was like, oh, I feel weird singing this song, you know, but everybody's singing it, so I got to sing it. And now I look back on it, and it horrifies me, you know? So I think making the movie now and having this distance, I think it helped tremendously. It didn't affect the narrative. Like, what's actually on the screen wasn't affected. I think the energy and the thought process, the approach to what ended up on the screen was different.
So one of the questions that I get a lot, and I'll assume maybe you get it a lot, is kind of like, why you? What was it about your circumstance, about you internally, that allowed you to go down a different path despite what we know most people who grew up in that circumstance, what their lives were like? What was it? And is that a question that you've gotten a lot or that you think about?
Yeah. I sometimes think about it, and when I do, I quickly move on to the next subject, because I think to come to an answer is to maybe arrive at something that distinguishes me from someone else and keeps you from the task of working to always, be good, you know, and do better. So I don't know. The only thing I can think of is that I was never interested in fitting in, you know. I was just totally cool and just sit on the side and kind of just watch people. And at a certain point, I think in that watching, I got to a place where I could just sort of manage the world around me, and it kind of insulated me.
Right. I mean, it seems like it's always a combination. There's something internally But it's not clearly just that you had the will yourself out of the circumstance.
Absolutely.
I think about my own life. I'm like, I did a lot of stupid shit. I didn't get caught doing most of it. So there was a lot of luck.
Mm-hmm. Same.
And then there were folks who looked out for you. So who looked out for you? Who helped change your course? And how did you even end up thinking about yourself as someone who could make films?
Yeah, you know, the biggest one was my grandma. And she was the person who, as I was growing up, just told me consistently that I was special. And she just stayed on me. And one of the really cool things she would do is she loved to fish. So she would take me out of the projects on the weekends to go fishing in the Everglades or in the Florida Keys. And then I would go back to school at Holmes Elementary. And I had this teacher in the third and fourth grade, this blonde Jewish woman from New York who moved to Miami because I guess she liked the nightlife. But she wanted to do good. So she taught at this elementary school in the hood. And when she found out my grandma was taking us on these trips on the weekends, she would have me write down what the trip was. She said, you know, look, Barry, you're the only person who's getting out of the neighborhood on the weekends. So you should write your story down and share it with the other kids. And so between these two women...
Wow.
This was, and I only realized it way later after the fact, this was this sort of thing of this reinforcement of that your voice is worth telling or the life you're living is something to take note of.
So I developed that, which a lot of people say is a coldness, but I'm actually really warm on the inside. I just...
Same. I'm such a warm person. However...
Yes. I'm like, you will never know the emotions that I feel. But I feel them. But I think, I mean, for me, like, my dad was an alcoholic, so, and he could get, you know, he had a lot of rage. So it was learning to study, right? That's how I became such an observer, is I need to know his moods. Mm-hmm. I need to know, like, is he happy? How drunk is he? Mm-hmm. Do I need to get out of the way? Can I be in the room? Mm-hmm. And it seems like this is also what Chiron has to do with his mom.
Who the hell you think you is? Huh? Yeah. That's what I thought.
You gonna raise him?
You gonna keep selling me rocks? Huh?
And so this gets to, you know, the difficult part of the interview, which is so much of this is about your mom and your relationship with your mom. Did you have to become that type of observer? It seems like when you have that type of dysfunction, also when you have to grow up faster than you should, and you have to learn to understand things that you probably shouldn't have to understand as a kid.
I did. And yeah, I think my mom did a great job, you know, as much as she could with, again, keeping some of those things away. So I didn't have to dodge them. I think the flip side, though, is, you know, if you're a perceptive kid, a sharp kid, you start to notice things that are being hidden from you. At the same time, there were so many things that happened, you know, right in front of me, that happened right in front of kids who grew up this way, that nobody tells you how to process. And so, again, you end up kind of like burying those things, you know.
Like what types of things?
No, I mean, there were a few times where I would see my mom outside the house and not fully herself, you know. And the way you process it, two ways. One, you go, who else is seeing this? You know, even as a kid, you go, who else is seeing this? And then you have to reconcile that image with the memory you have, you know, of this person, you know, fully together.
All right. So when you say you're not bitter, is that true?
Like, it is true.
Really?
I'm not. Not at all. To be bitter is to say that I was owed a better childhood. I was owed a better circumstance. And that's just not true.
No?
No. I mean, I'm here, you know? I mean, right?
You are here.
And also, too, I understand what the world was like when I was born. I don't blame any of these men or women who became addicted to this drug. It was not the perfect storm. It was an undeniable storm of how all these things happened.
So I definitely think of myself as a broken person, and I wonder, do you think of yourself that way, too?
Hey, yeah, for sure. I mean, clearly, you can't go, I'll acknowledge that, you can't go through those things and emerge fully intact, you know?
How are you broken?
I often say that in the film, the main character is this guy who's wandering around feeling like he's unworthy of love, you know? And I think I went through that process very, very legitimately feeling like I was, you know, unworthy of love. And you have to always when you've ever felt that way and really believed it, you have to constantly do this work to remind yourself that that is not true.
Barry Jenkins is nominated for Best Director at Sunday's Academy Awards. It's one of the 8 Oscar nominations for his film. And Nicole Hannah-Jones just won a National Magazine Award for a Times Magazine piece she wrote about the difficult and personal choice of choosing a school for her daughter in a segregated city. Here's what else you need to know today. In Mexico on Thursday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson sought to mend an increasingly strained relationship post-election.
Although our two nations share a long history, our visit was forward-looking, focusing on common interests that would advance security and economic well-being.
Back in the United States, the president complicated that message by telling business leaders that the U.S. would, in his words, no longer be treated unfairly by Mexico.
In our meetings, we jointly acknowledged that in a relationship filled with vibrant colors, two strong sovereign countries from time to time will have differences.
And the founder and chief executive of Uber is vowing to change the company amid mounting accounts of its cutthroat, male-dominated culture. The Times reported that an Uber manager groped a female coworker at a company retreat, that a director shouted a homophobic slur at a subordinate, and that a manager threatened to beat an underperforming worker with a baseball bat. Travis Kalanick, Uber's CEO, told employees he is determined to make the company a better place to work. "What I can promise you," he told them, "is that I will get better every day." The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom, Andy Mills, and Lisa Tobin, with support from Sam Dolnick. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Pedro Rosado is our studio manager. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Special thanks to Michaela Bouchard and Brita Green. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you on Monday.